Welcome to everybody. It's a pleasure to have you with us for the 2022 Anne Lambton Memorial Lecture that we are hosting in partnership with the British Institute of Persian Studies at the British Academy in London. I'm Anousheh Tashami. I'm director of the Institute for Middle Eastern Islamic Studies at Durham University, and it's a pleasure to be able to moderate this year's lecture and to be able to welcome everybody to this occasion. This, believe it or not, is Anne Lambton Memorial Lecture Series in its third decade. So we are privileged to be able to continue this momentous occasion, which is part and parcel of IMICE's annual cycle of activities. We look forward to this every spring. And I have to say that the first of these lectures was in fact inaugurated, was given by the great lady herself in the early 1990s in person in Durham. And I can tell you that was a terrifying sight to be sitting in front of her and listening to her and not daring to ask any questions when she finished. So when she did finish, there was utter silence. And she had to prompt the audience to engage with her, and the engagement was extensive. We're also privileged to be able to publish her lecture, which was probably the last bit of writing that she did before she passed away. So this series started as Anne Lambton Lecture Series, but since her passing has become the Anne Lambton Memorial Lecture Series. And in that time, we've had some of the most distinguished scholars in the field to give this memorial lecture. They've come from every corner of the world, including Iran itself, and have shed light on so many aspects of Iran: its politics, its history, its people, its governance, its society, its geopolitics, its art and culture, and its place in the world. And it has been a privilege to be part of this series from the very beginning of the process. And I have to thank Professor Paul Luft, my colleague and chair of the Anne Lambton Memorial Lecture Series at Durham, for having championed this over the years and has given me the privilege of moderating, chairing the session this year. Without Paul's input, none of this would have been possible. Nor indeed would have been possible to have you all here without the continuing support of BIPS, who have been our stalwart partners, and they are again this year in hosting us and also recording this year's lecture. This is a splendid occasion, and we are delighted and honored to be partnering this with BIPS on an annual basis as it stands. It's very important to us, and I'm delighted that Cydia and her colleagues have been so instrumental in ensuring that we all gather here for this lecture. I said that over the years, we've had many of the greatest minds working on Iran, modern, ancient, historical, and other aspects of the country and civilization over the years, and this year is no exception. We've got a very distinguished scholar who spent many years studying so many different aspects of Iran that he could give about 10 of these memorial lectures over 10 years, given the depth and breadth of his knowledge about this country and the region more broadly. And that is Professor Ali Qaisari from University of San Diego. Professor Qaisari is a British graduate, I'm delighted to say, who did his PhD at the University of Oxford and St. Andrews College back in 1989, which to me is recent history. But Ali also holds very distinguished positions elsewhere. In addition to San Diego, he's a visiting scholar at Brown University, at University of California, Irvine campus, and indeed continues to have close links with St. Anthony's College. Those who know Ali will know that he is a prolific scholar, writer, and has published on a wide range of themes to do with Iran, whether it is Iranian social history, its intellectual traditions, constitutionalism, literature, and even, I gather, food and culture he has an interest in. Today, though, Ali has agreed to talk to us about a subject that perhaps resonates more strongly today, given what Russia is doing to Ukraine, than it might have done previously. And that is about unequal treaties and the question of sovereignty in Qajar and early Pahlavi Iran. So without any further ado, Professor Qaisari, welcome to you, welcome to our audience, and the floor is yours, sir.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation and very kind introduction. It's a pleasure to be here. This presentation will be an overview of the Russian and British leverage in Iran during the Qajar and early Pahlavi periods through unequal treaties as one channel of extending their imperial influence and counterbalancing each other's rival presence. Although Iran was never directly colonized, its sovereignty was frequently compromised by competing foreign interests, as reflected in a number of unequal treaties and concessions, which in effect created a semi-colonial situation for the country during the 19th and early 20th centuries. The signing of such treaties, however, in spite of their unequal terms, was prompted by a complex set of motives that have often been overlooked or conflated in Iranian nationalist historiography. For instance, in spite of a generally negative assessment of treaties and concessions as a symptom of Qajar incompetence, at the time of signing, they were viewed by many among the state officials as necessary means to safeguard sovereignty in the case of treaties, or opportunities to modernize the economy in the case of concessions, and thereby perhaps even deserving to receive recognitions. But such views were seldom shared by those who were operating outside the parameters of the state, and in general were also dismissed by common opinion. Consequently, signing of major treaties and concessions often fed directly into a nationalist counter-discourse bent on questioning Qajar legitimacy, as can be seen, for example, in the violent reactions to the Turkmenchay Treaty of 1828, or during the tobacco concession protests in 1891-92. On the other hand, a significant agreement, such as the Darcy concession of 1901 for the exploration of oil in southern Iran, was challenged effectively only half a century later, during the oil nationalization movement, by which time oil had assumed a considerably more significant economic and political dimensions. There were also other forms of negotiations relating to Iran that bypassed the Iranian state altogether, such as the Anglo-Russian agreement of 1907, dividing Iran into the British and Russian zones of influence, as in fact the poster for the talk captured, the map in the poster. It is also important to note the role of state and non-state ideology in shaping Iranian historical memory, be it oral, textual, or material. For instance, there was a clear contrast between the manner in which the Pahlavi state portrayed foreign agreements that were signed by the Qajar state and the depiction of its own agreements. The Qajars were portrayed as a weak and corrupt state that through outside pressure repeatedly compromised Iran's sovereignty, whereas agreements conducted by the Pahlavi state were admittedly carried out on fair or even equal footing to better serve national interests. This kind of state-sponsored historical interpretation under the Pahlavis was expectedly challenged by its opponents, but without attempting in any way to rehabilitate the records of the preceding Qajar state. In fact, the term capitulation in French pronunciation involved a distinctly negative tone in the Iranian nationalist political language in the 20th century. And the abolition of capitulations was therefore viewed as a priority by many among the country's statesmen or the opposition figures alike. Legal reforms of the early Pahlavi period were in part presented as a step in that direction, especially with regard to the codification of the civil law and the introduction of modern procedural laws, ranging from the penal code to commercial laws affecting both domestic and foreign nationals. Within the limitations of time, I will attempt to address certain aspects of these observations in three interrelated parts. First, we shall be dealing with a general discussion on unequal treaties, especially the Golestan and the Turkmenchai between Russia and Iran and their implications. Subsequently, the Qajar state's traditional perspective on sovereignty and its ways of maintaining it, and Iran's semi-colonial condition will be discussed in the second section. Subsequently, by building on modern requisites of sovereignty based on the paradigm of nation states, and by introducing a number of corresponding legal and administrative reforms that were initiated in late 1920s and early 1930s, the early Pahlavi state set out to remove capitulatory agreements, a topic that will be briefly addressed in the last section. Treaties in general refer to agreements between sovereign states, and concessions are usually given by sovereign states to individuals or to private companies, whether domestic or foreign. At the outset, it should be qualified that not all treaties that Iran signed in the 19th or 20th centuries were unequal or discriminatory, as certain treaties that catered to specific regional and international interests were often mutually beneficial for the duration of such agreements. Such as, for example, the treaties of Erzurum between Iran and the Ottoman Empire that settled their border disputes, or the Treaty of Paris that ended the Anglo-Persian War and resolved the differences over the border between Iran and Afghanistan. However, signing of the two clearly unequal treaties of Golestan and Turkmenchai were forced upon Iran following a series of military setbacks and territorial losses. And the gravely unequal terms of Turkmenchai set precedence for subsequent capitulatory terms that other countries, while drawing on the principle of the most favored nation, included in treaties that they signed with Iran in the 19th century. Restoration of state authority and its maintenance in the early Qajar period was a particularly complex episode in Iran's modern history. The efforts of the dynasty's founder, Agha Mohammad Khan, were almost entirely consumed by his priority of consolidating his hold over his newly conquered domain and reestablishing sovereignty over vast territories that that had been fragmented since the fall of the Safavids in the early 18th century. Many of these regions were later reunified under the Afsharid rule and the Zand dynasty during Iran's long 18th century, including large areas of Georgian territory in the Caucasus before fragmenting in the course of tribal and intertribal warfare again, with the Qajars ultimately succeeding the short-lived Zand dynasty. This brought the Qajars on collision course with the Russians, who around the same period had set out to expand their territorial hold in the Caucasus by annexing Georgia in early 1800s. During the reign of the second Qajar sovereign, Fath Ali Shah, the new rounds of Russo-Persian Wars, 1804-1813, resulted in substantial Iranian territorial losses. These were outlined in the Treaty of Golestan and was signed in October 1813. It concluded an almost decade-long conflict and resulted in many unfavorable concessions by Iran. These included Russian possession of several important khanates in both North and South Caucasus, including Karabakh, Ganja, Shirvan, Shaki, Darband, and Baku, as well as parts of Tailish and the fortress at Lankoran. Iran further abandoned its claims to other areas such as Dagestan, Georgia, and Abkhazia, including villages and towns on the coast of the Black Sea. Although the degree of the Persian hold on those territories is quite debatable and fluid, in fact. Iran also conceded navigation rights to Russian commercial ships going to Iranian ports, as well as exclusive rights to keep naval force in the Caspian Sea. The late George Bournoutian's last book offers one of the more recent studies of these rounds of conflict between Iran and Russia. Both sides further agreed to establish free trade, which with each side given access to their respective domestic markets. On the other hand, Russia agreed to recognize and support the designated crown prince, Abbas Mirza, and his descendants as the heir to the Persian throne. From the Iranian point of view, such specification would also simultaneously ensure, at least on paper, that Russia would recognize the Qajar Sultanate as a sovereign domain and its line of succession. We should also take into account the uneven military capabilities of two sides, with Iran lagging behind in terms of both military technology and organization. In a way, come to think of it, the Qajars had inherited a gunpowder empire, but without the gunpowder. Furthermore, there was the impact of certain non-military factors during the war, not all of which could be blamed on the recently established Qajar dynasty. For instance, among such factors were the occasional interference of Shia hierarchy and tribal forces with the Qajar state's conduct of the war. But adding further to the complexity of the situation, some of these interventions had in fact been initially asked for by powers within the state itself, as in the case of, for example, encouraging the high-ranking ulama to declare jihad in order to mobilize irregular regiments to the war effort, which at the end turned out to be counterproductive. On equal terms of Golestan and its unclear demarcation of boundaries, subsequently paved the way for renewed conflict, and some 13 years later caused the next rounds of Russo-Persian wars in 1826-28. In this round, initially Iran gained some of the territories that it had lost, but once the Russian forces received new supplies and more advanced weapons, they succeeded in inflicting a severe blow, severe defeat on the Iranian army. This in turn resulted in the Treaty of Turkmenchai that was signed on 10th of February, 1828. The new treaty forced Iran to give up additional territories in South Caucasus, including Khanates of Yerevan, Nakhchivan, and the rest of Tailesh, as well as the Ordubad and Mogan regions in the South Caucasus. The new border between Russia and Iran was now set on the Aras River. In addition to territorial losses, Iran was also forced to agree to pay Russia a large financial settlement, estimated at 10 crore tumans. Crore was about 500,000 tumans, each crore, in gold, or 20 million silver rubles at the time. Shortly after the end of the war and signing of the treaty, the Russian mission in Tehran was attacked by an angry mob, and the event resulted in a massacre of the mission staff and the Russian delegation traveling to Iran to collect the first installment of the war indemnity. Among those who lost their lives was the newly appointed 35-year-old Russian ambassador and noted playwright, Alexander Gribaidov, who himself had a significant part in negotiations and signing of the treaty. In addition to all this, the Turkmenchai Treaty is also associated with granting capitulation rights to Russian subjects in Iran. Although prior to this, a number of capitulation agreements had already existed between Iran and other countries, The general perception of the Turkmen trial was that it had gravely undermined Iran's sovereignty in principle and in practice. The question of sovereignty and its maintenance continued as a major political and legal preoccupation throughout the Qajar period. In practical terms, and drawing on a wealth of scholarly contributions, it can be argued that an overriding notion of sovereignty in terms of quote unquote guarded domains, mamalik-e mahruse, that the Qajars had inherited from their predecessors, most specifically from the Safavids, was a normative set of arrangements, albeit informal and unwritten, between the institution of the crown, sultanates, and different regions and provinces within the realm, including the central as well as the frontier areas. For instance, the term was used by the noted Iranian statesman, Qaim Maqam Farahani, who had reflected on the causes and consequences of Iran's defeat in the wars with Russia that he had witnessed. In the 19th century, Iran was pulled into the theater of power politics at the time it was least prepared for. The Qajars had only seized the throne effectively in 1796 after defeating internal tribal rivals. While lacking a coherent central administration and full control of the entire country, and without a modern military, and instead chiefly reliant on different tribal armed contingents, they found themselves simultaneously at war with Russia over Georgia and the Caucasus, while drawn into the European balance of power during the Napoleonic Wars, at the time when Britain was expanding its territorial hold in the Indian subcontinent and the Persian Gulf. These wars posed a direct challenge to the early Qajars' attempt towards consolidating the weak state and its territory and building its quote unquote fragile frontiers. Loss of territory, bankruptcy of the treasury, and accumulating debt, among other factors, threatened Qajar legitimacy and eroded its self-representation as the protector of the guarded domain. Such unwritten set of arrangements that have also been referred to in terms of quote unquote the Qajar Pact entailed granting and subsequently recognizing a degree of relative autonomy by the center, the embodiment of which was the institution of the crown to different regions and provinces. Together, they form the collectivity of the so-called Qajar domain. By extension, the Qajar Pact can also be seen in terms of an unwritten series of negotiations and expectations among the central institution of the crown and different regional political networks. It included manifold layers of tacit pacts between the center and provinces, between the political elite and different social classes, and among different social classes themselves. In a sense, the analytical premise or the paradigm of Qajar Pact was built on the memory of the Safavid state and adhered to its principal political foundations, both ideational, that is Shiism, and institutional, that is the ministerial office and its branches, collectively referred to as the Divan. It is important to also note that in its early 19th century wars with Russia, Iran stood alone, notwithstanding the intermittent and minor French and British assistance, including as part of Abbas Mirza's scheme of modernizing the army. Because its guarded domain was no longer part of any larger Muslim dominion, when Safavids broke off doctrinal paths with the Ottomans, Iran was no longer part of, to borrow somewhat anachronistically, the lands of the Eastern Caliphate. Although this term has an Orientalist overtone, its use here is not to imply the applicability of any sort of Muslim pact. Rather, it is intended to echo a gradual formation of an Iranian perception of domain and territoriality, which came to be as much geographic as it was linguistic, denominational, military, and administrative. The Ottomans too had their own series of wars with Iran, which in one way or the other were settled in the 18th century, notwithstanding later Ottoman territorial incursions during the Iranian Constitutional Revolution and or during the First World War, as well as Iranian incursions into Anatolia and Ottoman Iraq. Therefore, in the 19th century, in the absence of a centralized administration and a centrally organized force, such informal arrangements was the Qajar state's method of maintaining sovereignty at home. A method which can be described in terms of rule by proxy or perhaps franchised statecraft. Furthermore, resorting to such a franchised method at home also complemented the Qajar state's accepting or accommodating capitulatory terms in its foreign treaties such as Turkmenchai, which in spite of its unequal terms, secured an international recognition of Qajar sovereignty, a territory and specified dynastic lineage. In Iran, signing of agreements with foreign powers, notably with Russia and Britain, and foreign subjects, by and large fell under two broad categories, namely treaties such as Golestan and Turkmenchai, the signing of which were forced upon the Iranian state, and different types of agreements, such as the ones on a short railway in 1886, tobacco in 1890, and oil in 1901. That the state signed in order to attract investment and benefit from royalties. An obvious dimension in concessions and capitulatory treaties, in spite of their differences, was that in principle, capitulatory clauses were presented as reciprocal arrangements. Although in reality, prospects of real reciprocity to materialize in Iran's advantage in the 19th century were dim or even non-existent. On the other hand, recognition of reciprocity in itself was an affirmation that the weaker party was not a colony of the stronger state. In this arrangement, one would capitulate on legal matters relating mostly to the domain of private law regarding the subjects of the other state, but was not going to relinquish its own sovereignty, that is the domain of public law. By extension, granting of concessions to foreign interests from around 1850s through 1910s, either directly by the crown or by some of its regional governors who occasionally operated as de facto provincial rulers, like Prince Zelo Sultan in Isfahan, for instance, was generally perceived by those who were being adversely impacted, such as merchants and their clerical supporters, as an extension of a pattern that had begun by unequal treaties. Hence, on unequal treaties and the capitulation regime on the one hand, and concessions on the other, were often being regarded in the public eye as two faces of the same reality. A general perception that from time to time challenged the legitimacy of the crown and its agents, its representatives as defenders of the faith and protectors of the country and its subjects. However, this So although this trend should not be ignored, it should not be exaggerated either. Since many of the clergy who, for example, supported the tobacco protest or even the constitutional revolution of 1906 had no intention of bringing about the collapse of the Qajar state, if there was any sort of Qajar pact, it was indeed between the Qajar state and the high-ranking clerics in terms of their mutual dependence. However, that did not prevent either side from occasionally challenging the authority of the other. There were different levels and dimensions to any form of consensus between the two. In this context, perhaps we can identify a complex configuration of three analytical trajectories that in just over half a century, from late 1860s to late 1920s, evolved from the state opting to grant concessions with or without unequal treaties, to B, challenges to such concessions by forces from within as well as outside the parameters of the state, who in spite of their ideological differences on whether to reform or to undermine Qajar legitimacy, eventually move towards agreeing on a constitutional solution, albeit short term. And C, formation of a modern centralized state under the banner of quote unquote state nationalism, and the dismantling of many key structures of the Qajar state, as well as an attempted revision of Iran's relations with foreign powers. Here, perhaps another point on the side is that domestically, in almost 10 to 15 short years, say from 1910s to late 1920s, we can see a clear shift in political mindset from having too little state during the late Qajar period towards the idea of having too much state under the early Pahlavi period. I have briefly discussed this elsewhere, and if there is time, I'll be happy to talk about it further during the Q&A. The above argument may have also been a reflection of a revisionist assessment within the imperial mindset that could approximately be traced back to the mid-19th century. Seen from this perspective, a distant colonial power such as Britain could have exploited the resources of a foreign territory without having to actually colonize it. Because by the mid-19th century, colonization had already resulted in all sorts of demands, obligations, and antipathies. The argument here extends to the contested principle of the so-called imperialism of free trade, while also more broadly distinguishing between formal and informal empires, maintaining that the preservation of free trade at times served as a pretext for imposing informal or formal imperial hegemony, as in the case of the British in China. Paralleling this mode of reasoning, it may also be suggested that by signing reciprocal capitulation agreements, the party that had the upper hand would on the one hand secure the legal protection and jurisdiction of its own subjects, and on the other hand, free itself from any moral or juridical obligations towards the weaker partner, while claiming that the agreement was mutually beneficial to both states. Moreover, Iran, while increasingly assuming a semi-colonial status in the 19th century, did not become an outright colony of either the British or the Russian empires. Not because they had already lost the momentum for their respective colonial or for that matter, territorial ambitions, but perhaps because Iran played a balancing act between the two rival powers that bordered it. something that from time to time was also being noted abroad, as can be seen, for example, in these three cartoons that had appeared in the Punch of London in different periods, such as, for example, this one in 1873, showing the Russian bear shackles in the background as the Persian cat cuddles with the British lion. It was believed that the British interests in the East were safe, whilst stable relations maintained with Iran. Or this one in 1907, The Harmless Necessary Cat, which speaks for it for herself. Or this one in 1911, As Between Friends. And 1911 being the time that the Russians occupied Tabriz and some areas in Azerbaijan in the aftermath of the Constitutional Revolution. By the late 19th century, the rise of a militarist and unified Germany with its own formal and informal imperial aspirations also affected Anglo-Russian relations, including in Iran. Shortly after the Iranian Constitutional Revolution of 1906, Britain and Russia concluded an agreement in 1907 that at least temporarily resolved their century-old rivalry in Iran in order to offset the potential German threat to their interests. Britain and Russia were also keen on avoiding common frontiers in Iran that could lead to future direct military confrontation between them. The closest that Iran came in late Qajar period to a colonial situation was its division into zones of influence in the 1907 agreement, which divided Iran into the Russian and British zones of influence with a nominally neutral buffer zone in the middle. The regional developments following the First World War effectively changed geopolitical calculations affecting Iran. Although the preferred imperial option of finding strong allies had not yet materialized, and I admit this is a counterfactual assumption, instead, one could see a regionalized approach by the sole imperial player, Britain, throughout the Middle East, including Iran. In the period after the First World War, the region witnessed a sudden absence of two former imperial powers, briefly Russia, in the immediate aftermath of the Bolshevik seizure of power, and the Ottoman Empire that began to dismantle after the Great War. Meanwhile, elsewhere in the larger region, France, an ally of Britain, emerged from the war devastated and could not even secure all the territories in the former Ottoman Empire that the 1916 Sykes-Picot Agreement had allotted to her. And the US, in accordance with its stated isolationism in foreign policy, was withdrawing from international entanglements. In effect, Britain was the dominant imperial player in the region, with a vastly expanded empire, a depleted economy, and the prospects of benefiting from the resources of the weaker countries in the region, in particular regarding oil. In the ill-fated 1919 Anglo-Persian Agreement, the Iranian government, headed by the Premier Wasuq, agreed to the British protection for its foreign affairs and to the British supervision for its domestic reorganization and reform. Imperial pursuit of regional politics was viewed by Wasuq with a greater sense of anxiety and prompted his government in 1919 to negotiate the agreement that he believed would offset any potential imperial designs to dismantle Iran's territory, and thus delivering Iran to a semi-protectorate status would be a better option before imperial interests would indulge on regionalizing the country. In this context, we can further refer to the fear of communism and also to the remaining forces of the Ottoman Empire in Anatolia, who were struggling to survive against the continued Allied onslaught, mostly by the British forces. The 1919 agreement was also largely aimed at bolstering Mosul's own leverage in Iranian politics to strengthen the reach of the central government in the provinces and in tribal regions, and to prevent the widespread, the spread of regional insurgencies similar to the Jangal movement. At the time, the British also had military leverage in Iran, such as the South Persia Rifles and the Norpor Force. Vosoul's maneuvering could also be seen as a microcosm of broader trend by Iranian statesmen throughout the Qajar period to preserve Iran's territorial integrity. The 1919 Anglo-Persian Agreement was never ratified by the Iranian parliament. On the contrary, the parliamentary discussions over the draft of the agreement triggered a nationalist backlash, which in effect was as much anti-Wusugh and anti-British as it was anti-Qajar. In retrospect, those parliamentary debates set the stage for the 1921 coup and the eventual rise to power of Brigadier General Reza Khan, and culminated in the fall of Qajar dynasty and founding of the Pahlavi state by 1925. As mentioned above, although the Qajar Pact was a domestic political solution that was adopted by the Qajar state in the course of the 19th century in order to maintain sovereignty, from mid-1920s onwards, there was almost a complete reversal in this arrangement by the early Pahlavi states. Instead of reproducing any pact between the center and the provinces, the Pahlavi state was determined to bring provinces as well as all social classes under the singular jurisdiction of the center. Although there were several attempts and initiatives in mid to late Qajar period to reform the law and better organize its administration, a more systematic work took place during the early Pahlavi period. In particular, reforming the legal system in early Pahlavi Iran had two immediate motivations. First, it was prompted by a political decision to take the task of the administration of justice away from clerical control and place it under the state's constitutional prerogative, hence also introducing uniformity in the application of the laws within the country as its sovereign domain. As I have argued elsewhere, in this regard, the early Pahlavi's opposition to the clerics was not entirely jurisprudential, but to a large extent administrative, and in a narrow sense of the term, sociological, in the sense that the state was adamant to enlist independently trained and independently retained personnel for the judiciary and put in place ways and procedures that were independent of the traditional Sharia-based informal methods, although the core of the civil law was drawn from Shia law. The second motivation was to formally annul existing capitulations. This was specified in an announcement in May 1927 by Iran's foreign ministry, revoking previous capitulatory treaties. In a follow-up letter to the British legation, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs outlined some 18 articles on Iran's new judicial commitments on preserving the rights, freedom, and properties of British subjects in Iran. Similar letters were also sent to US and German, and later to the French, Swedish, and Danish legations. One of the earliest accounts on the abolition of capitulation regime in Iran was published in 1930 by Ahmad Matin Daftari, who was involved in several aspects of judicial reforms during the early Pahlavi period. For the most part, Matin Daftari's book portrays some examples, is a descriptive, in fact, account of some examples of similar efforts in other countries as part of their political modernization. The issue here is articulated within the general framework of identifying political with legal sovereignty and recognizing legal sovereignty as an indispensable attribute or condition of political sovereignty. In fact, Matin Daftari presented his arguments within a straightforward constitutional framework, which in the case of Iran, in the period that necessary institutions of modern states had not yet materialized, was clearly etatist. Here, the modern notion of sovereign nation state involved a constitutional framework in which citizenship rights were recognized in principle and gradually institutionalized also in practice. The new approach replaced the traditional or pre-modern notions associated with the concept of domain, in which personal rights were primarily demarcated along confessional and denominational lines, which, as I have already mentioned, was the main legal grounds that justified earlier reciprocal provisions in international treaties for granting capitulatory concessions to foreign nationals during the Qajar period. Finally, the early Pahlavi modernization vision also gradually dissociated itself from the notion that concessions were in fact beneficial to national economy. Therefore, by adopting the conceptual and institutional prerogatives of nation states, legal reforms of the early Pahlavi period set out to present a modern framework and a new narrative in order to more clearly define citizenship and sovereignty. And I think we may be running out of time, so I better stop here. Thank you very much for your patience on this.
Ali, that was absolutely outstanding. Thank you so much for such a rich and contoured and detailed discussion of this crucial period in the formation of the modern state. I myself learned a huge amount from you, and I look forward to reading the paper and also listening again and again to the broadcast of your lecture. I already have one question, and if I may, Ali, I'll go straight to that one. I have my own questions, but I will keep my powder dry because the audience are much more important than what I have to say. Dr. Rai Mutashem has thanked you for your lecture and has asked, so what is your view of the richness of the archival material on the Qajar period? Do you think that there is still more material undisclosed on this period? And if that is the case, where do you think these undisclosed archives might be. Are they in Iran, in the UK, in Russia, or elsewhere?
Thank you very much. This is a fascinating question and very close to heart, in fact. Archives vary. In the period that we were talking about, the complex states that Iran had relations with, in Russia, Britain, France, and of course later Germany in its own right, all had archives. Iranian state didn't. As I have written about this again elsewhere, in a hypothetical working day of the week, it was not the minister who would walk to the ministry. It was the ministry who would walk to the home/office of the minister. So much of the paperwork of his ministry were held in the private space of ministerial families. And usually sons would inherit father's jobs, or if fathers would fell from grace, some, not all of the paperwork would be transferred to household of a new ministerial family and so forth. One exception here is from the time of Amir Kabir, if I'm not mistaken, copies of foreign contracts, so-called Sawad-e Mukatabat, were kept, and especially from the time of Sepah Salar, an annex in the Golestan Palace was allocated to keep foreign concessions and treaties and so forth. But the rest were pretty much in the in private hands. You did not have anything prior to the Pahlavi state compared to, let's say, public record office in Britain. So the importance of archiving and digitizing and studying private papers are immensely important. And in more recent decades, there has been a systematic effort, although not coordinated, to digitize and to collect these. But I can really go on for a long time, because in PRO's case, or German and of course Russian archives, very rich, the state officials who generated those reports, definitely one should not ignore such reports, but should not exaggerate either, as personnel of the of a foreign power, they were not using any scholarly or critical or comparative in reporting or narrative. Simply the time factor was not there. So by putting together these pieces of puzzle, one would gradually develop a better perception. But thank you very much. This is a fascinating subject.
Thank you for that, Ali. I have another question. Khanum Fariba Zarinbaf, great talk, Ali, thank you. So she asks that we know that Iranian bureaucrats and Nader Shah himself were very adept in negotiating treaties with the Ottomans. And we know this from primary sources. But what was the process in negotiating these treaties and concessions with Britain and Russia?
Thank you very much, Professor Zarinbaf. She's quite an authority in constitutional period, Azerbaijan and the Ottoman archives, speaking of which. Yeah, the bureaucrats, if I understood the second part of the question well, case by case it differs. For example, you have cases like tobacco, which the royalties and the down payments were attractive, and that was something of a business venture prospect, which attracted many people's attentions, including Nasreddin Shah himself. Then there were treaties, or rather concessions, for example, on the excavation of antiquities, which were done almost in total oblivion of the public opinion or knowledge of future significance or value. In the written version of the talk that I just presented, I have dealt with these exceptions. But directly to Faribault's question, you know, the ministerial, again, if I have understood the question correctly, you know, the ministerial initiatives of participating in such agreements with the foreign companies or states had to be ironed out with the crown or the power centers. I mean, speaking of Nasreddin Shah, one such agreement or concession which was signed by a very close courtier, Malcolm Khan, managed to, you know, over the lottery, managed to alienate himself irreversibly in the hands of his sovereign. So in a sense, there was a coordination. Again, if I understood the question.
Thank you for that. I'm sure that Professor Zarimov will come back if further clarification is needed. One colleague has asked, would it be possible to know about the termination, the determination or termination of the Turkmenchai Treaty, please? Is it over now?
Yes, it was over during the second half of, when Iran paid in the last part of the indemnities. But more symbolically, although in terms of the payments, those were clear to a very large extent. The more symbolic came after 1917, that the Bolsheviks annulled all the previous concessions and on equal treaties by the Tsars on quote unquote the Oriental peoples. And that was a major PR for Lenin personally. In fact, there were some eulogies of Lenin by famous poets at the time, Orev and others, who praised the Bolshevik initiatives in canceling those claims, or even by Malko Sharab Bahar in the introduction, the second volume, if I'm not mistaken, A Short History of Political Parties, in early 1920s, it acknowledges the both Comintern and especially the new socialist government in Russia to have made a declaration of such exits from the Tsarist capitulatory agreements and concessions.
Thank you. Dear friend John Limbert, hello John, has written thanking you for your excellent presentation and asked the question, could you address what the psychological effects of these unequal treaties might have been, particularly Turkmenchai Treaty? How do we see those effects today, he asks.
Huge question, and a tough one. the psychological impact was very heavy and in fact immediate, as it reflected almost immediately by the storming of the Russian legation in Tehran shortly after the Turkmenchai was signed. And it sort of continued. The field of approaching this historical from a psychological point of view, it's interesting, but it's very difficult. To just speculate, one antidote probably in the course of the 19th century, as I alluded to, hinted briefly, was to blame it all on the weakness of Qajar state. So in a sense, in the national psyche, the Turkmenchai, as much as the Russians were responsible, obviously, so were the Qajars, as a state. And there was a kind of separating the account of the state from the account of the nation in the public psyche. So this dichotomy between what's popular and what is state has been one of the, in fact, traits, one of the characteristics of Persian political cultures, this millat-dowlat sort of dichotomies. And many of my good colleagues, Professor Katuzian, for instance, have expanded on this notion, millat-dowlat dichotomy. So in it, and that in itself was also probably, I don't want to sound cynical, but in the long term, it became a therapeutic method of getting over Turkmenchai and move forward. And also much of that moving forward process happened from mid 1920s onwards, when the Qajar state as a state was terminated, was brought down, and Pahlavi state as a new state, in no ambiguous terms, in much more ways than one, said that the cap meter is now turned on zero, it's a fresh start. And then this concept of territoriality that I talked about in a much more tangible, legal, literally symbolic, artistic, you name it, was being articulated ever since. And that, I think, provides some answer to John's excellent question.
Thank you, Ali. Professor Zarin Buff has come back and said that in her view, Qajar Shahs made these decisions directly. And there were no border commissions, for example, as in the case of the Ottoman Empire.
Yes.
I take that as a comment, if I may.
Yes, Faiba is authority on the subject, and mine is a footnote to.
You're very generous, Ali. Now, I'm glad you're sitting down, because the next question comes in three parts from Sir Parvane Prushariati, who very much enjoyed your talk.
Thank you.
So she says, first, the brilliant way in which you describe the decentralized nature of Qajar state, one can argue it can be traced back to the Sasanian period, if not the Hakhamanishi period. What do you think of the idea of Iran Shah in this context? That's the first one. She has two more. So why don't you take one each in turn?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Professor Prushariati. Thank you for attending. It's an honor. It's an excellent point. In fact, I talked about the memory of Safavid state, but we should also talk about the memory of pre-Islamic history, which very clearly is in full show during the reign of Fatali Shah, in the articulation of which, in fact, and as a booster shot, if you will, to that subjectivity, some British archaeologists had a role, for example, the Kerr Porter accounts, or the Rawlinson brothers, when they translated pre-Islamic cuneiforms and rock reliefs, and they were presented as concrete evidence of Iran's pre-Islamic heritage. You see that very clearly, that clear shift in the early Qajar period. You see these in rituals and in symbolic representation. Some of the paintings I showed, Fatali Shah and the sons. In fact, the crown itself, that Fateh Ali Shah used. It's referred to as Taj Kiani, the Kianid crown, which is distinctly pre-Islamic, to support your question. So in fact, yeah, the memory of the Safavid state was very much ministerial and operational, whereas Safavids, by way of the headdress, they were wearing some sort of elaborate turban, whereas the memory of the pre-Islamic Kianids came into full show in the Qajar period by that kind of iconography. And also you could see in later choices of Fateh Ali Shah's naming of his children that a very clear interest in tapping on Shahnameh and Persian names for the younger princes, and that is, as well as many of the ministers and the literati elite were adamant to write quote unquote pure Persian. I mean, this language purity also builds into that.
I think you should have a sip of water, because the other two parts, yes, to Professor Prochayati's question are also brilliant. So if you're ready, the second part of your question is, did interest in trade routes and routes of communications dictate the regional ways in which imperialism imposed itself on Iran?
Thank you very much. Well, yes, imperialism obviously used that, but those routes were longstanding. And to use the metaphor, people took much more mileage from those routes. These were primarily commercial routes connecting India to the Iranian mainlands, to Caucasus, and to Ottomans. And of course, one should not be too much Persian exceptionalist in the sense that all these routes were not just going through Iran. Many of them, they were in connection, for example, Herat to India, although there was an impossible landscape, but still there was a connection, or from Herat to Baku, Central Asia. But these primarily were commercial routes, roads and connections, through which not only goods and capital traveled, but also ideas. And each, in fact, received its own flavor. Not going to the economic history that has been explored by my good colleagues, you can also read some sort of a sociology of knowledge into what kind of the typology of ideas circulating. When you look at the treatises and the publications, including the emigre press and literature in these different zones, you can distinctly feel the flavor. For example, the Iranian diasporic, Persian diasporic communities in India, in the Caucasus, or in Istanbul. It is risky to generalize, but by and large, you feel very much the spirit of British political economy coming out of India. For example, when you read Mu'ayyadul Islam, the old Hablul Mateen, highly influential press, and even the creative works, in no time, in the second paragraph, I mean, they start on a very literary, even romantic, even idealized pitch, But the second paragraph goes into reform, and immediately, in order to reform, we need railway. We need electrification, we need telegraph. These are the bread and butter of British political economy. When you read stuff coming out of Istanbul, for varieties of reasons, quite complex and beyond our time, has a very distinct Central European, Germanic, Ottoman, and romantic nationalism. It's very much into glorifying the ancient power and confidence and juxtaposing it with contemporary weakness. So this is a characteristics of romantic nationalism. Or by the same token, when you look at literature coming out of the Caucasus, Baku, again, it's risky to generalize, but by and large, they're very radical. I mean, the take on state is that state is hopeless, you have to bring it down. It's very anarchistic somehow and quite radical. If you want to reform, don't negotiate with the state, bring it down. So in the sense, you have this, and of course it was not coincidental that many of these literature were being carried out, transported, posted, or smuggled into Iran through merchandise that were, these merchants were using. And again, it's no coincidence that many merchants in India, in Baku, in Istanbul, were sponsoring the emigre press and the intelligentsia. There was, of course, another route to Najaf and the Atabad in the Qajar period, which used, again, the Ottoman route, and that was the Shi'i, in fact, route. But the these three destinations that are shown briefly on that map corresponds to this. Thank you very much.
Of course, the Shi'a route is, again, alive and well in the 21st century, really. And her knockout punch, if you like, is a third question. And she asks, what do you think of the current Russian and Chinese treaties with Iran, Ali?
I'm still trying to make sense of the past.
you can't cop out. You can't cop out like that. I think that's a choice question coming by a learned scholar. So you can't cop
thank
out.
Thank you very much. No, I fully appreciate Parvana's question. This is, I'm sure, is very close to everybody's heart and minds and concerns. The news of the past month or so has been most regrettable and disheartening. Iran has been, in a sense, tried to navigate, if you will, its movements between superpowers. And one superpower which Iran dealt with in the 20th century in different periods, United States, at least in the more recent navigations of Iran, US was conveniently absent from the scene. So Iran gradually tried to bring in new compass and new navigation skills, working with China over the varieties of ventures from oil, et cetera. But having said that, there is a bit of uncertainty in the Iranian public opinions, and so much that I have managed to follow, and I must say I'm not all that up to date, but you could see that there is no clear line, if you will, whether working with Russia or the Chinese is foolproof. one thing which is has a deafening silence here is everybody in more ways than one is waiting to see what happens with the United States. That is a much more tangible element in the public as well as the state, I'm sure, psyche to try to sketch the kind of prospects for such navigation among the superpowers. So, short answer would be there is no set policy yet. In more ways than one, things are on hold to see what's happening with the US.
Thank you, Ali, for these comprehensive answers to what were fascinating questions. There are three more questions, and may I suggest that we bring the proceedings to an end after the three questions have been addressed, because you've been very generous, Ali, with your time. I know that my BIPS colleagues also have got the circumstances in mind as well. So if I may, I'll move on to the next question, which is, how do you assess the contribution of the Qajar statesmen and their negotiating skills in concluding treaties with foreign powers?
Yeah, wonderful.
That's a leading question, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is fascinating, and I wish more work, systematic work, would be forthcoming on that. The complexity of the question is that you need much more. I mean, you need more sort of analytical frameworks and perspectives in addressing this. It's not just a question of archives or who is in office, who is not. You have to define what you mean by Qajar state, first and foremost. And in this particular case, not so much institutional anymore, as I've been trying to argue. But to paraphrasing Plekhanov, the role of personality in history, as in all real life scenarios, you've got institutions there, but institutions are not run by robots. You are dealing with individuals, and very much the personal trajectories of these individuals overshadow their performance, and much, much, much more overshadows the future appraisal and assessment of their performance, sometimes fairly, sometimes unfairly. Some of the cases I mentioned, for example, Premier Wusu is the big and good case in point. That's how you go back and produce accounts on the basis of. But individuals, had great role. And this brings in or requires a very sophisticated analytic methodology. I concluded the part, the transition between late Qajar and early Pahlavi. Just that episode between 1921 and 1925, then you look at the people involved in negotiations with the, let's say, League of Nations over the capitulations, over the drafting of new civil law. You see these complexities. You have Fourouri and others in Paris practically being kept at dark, and people at the foreign ministry at home outlining and planning an alternative route. Now, whether it was you diversifying decision making, which is bad management, or was it a grand scheme behind it? I very much doubt the latter, but the role of personality in history kicks in, no matter what. And by and large, as politicians elsewhere, when you look at the records of individual statesmen, especially when they reminisce in retirement or later in life their memoirs, or even when we have the luxury of tapping on their daily journals, which are very rare. I mean, one exception was Etemad el-Saltaneh, and then you have others on the side. And fast forward, Alam, Asadullah Alam, in fact, was good. And I have written comparing these two sets of diaries, which are not memoirs. So they have a kind of, we have the benefit of spontaneity in their texture. Either memoirs or the diaries, you cannot help but notice that there is a sense of an ending, which time and again comes up, a sense of regret, a profound regret. Nevertheless, while they are in position, they have a sense of personal loyalty, because they had invested their lives, and they remain emotionally very much attached, rather than completely casting themselves out. So in a sense, they're, and to answer that question satisfactorily, we need to breaking it down to individuals and pick samples, important and revealing samples in a very hermeneutic sense for different periods that we are investigating. But thank you very much for this question. This is
I love your engagement with methodologies as well as the deep knowledge that you convey as well, Ali. This is absolutely remarkable. Thank you. Another of your admirers writes, Professor Manoj Iskandari Qajar, who congratulates you on your exceptional talk, as we all do. And his question is to do with cartography and the acquiring of knowledge on the part of Iranian state of modern cartographic knowledge. He asks, did that correct some of the disadvantages that the Iranian state might have had in suffering in its early encounters?
Thank you very much, my good friend, Professor Iskandari Qajar. It's an honor to have you in the audience. And I should congratulate you on your recent monumental publications on Mayor Mamalek. This is very important. I mean, the transition from flat cartographic sketches to some sort of geometric and geographic dimensions, which came out later, and I'm not quite well informed when exactly it came, but I've seen, let's say, from late 19th century, maps, which are cartographic maps rather than flat maps. If I'm not mistaken, they were associated, I mean, they came into full view by the early student groups that were sent during Fateh Ali Shah's time to Paris and elsewhere to study varieties of subjects, including medicine. And one was cartography. And later, cartography was one of the courses, and there was a set curriculum in the Darul Funun Polytechnic in Tehran from 1851 onwards, and that was directly staffed and in its own right trained the future staff for the logistics and for the sort of military use which was necessary. The map that comes to my mind, I think it was must have seen in Royal Asiatic Society, one of the early issues in late 19th century, when there was a cartographic map of from Bushehr to Kazerun and Shiraz, it was a completely different picture that average map would give us. I mean, if people had the view of that map, which in fact showed it from the side, meaning the heights and the hills and the extremely challenging landscape from Kazerun and Bushehr towards Shiraz, you'd see this whole concept of spatiality, of the terrain that we dealt with. And this is something which really historiography of the Qajar period needs to factor in. I think not only the vastness of the Iranian landscape had something to do with its isolation, its terrain, in the sense that Professor Iskandari Qajar is asking, had a direct, in fact, role in that. And I quite agree with that. I mean, if Iran, for example, had the landscape that Greece had, for example, it was accessible by boat, it would not have the same political history as it had during the Qajar period.
Yeah, it's all about geography. Thank you, Ali. And last but not least, again, I'm afraid it's a question in three parts, so feel free to take which bits you want, because I appreciate that you know, we've been having you engage with us for an hour and a half now, and you've been very generous. And this is from Professor Shekhovsky. He also thanks you, as the rest of us have done, for your amazing presentation. He has three questions, and I'll take them in turn. He asked the first question: given that in earlier periods we had some kind of central archives or at least register of copies, why was there no comeback of this practice under the Qajars?
Could you repeat the first part?
Like, for example, Daftar-e Khulud, that if they existed in earlier periods, why wasn't that practice continued under the Qajars of creating central archives or registers of copies?
As I alluded to earlier in the presentation, the Qajars pulled the states together, or as much of it as they could salvage, through a period of campaigns. And the previous archives were not exactly handed over intact. I mean, following the sack of Isfahan by the Afghans in the 18th century, then Afsharids and the Zands, Iran lost a storage house, if you will, for its paperwork. The tradition and the genre, as I try to briefly argue in that blog, Khat u Rabt, the skill of arranging documents, even the aesthetics of writing sanads and documents stayed. And not only through the calligraphic skills, but also compositional skills. And that has remained ever since. I mean, there was it was understood that a document, your skill of drafting as a good munshi, as a good scribe, you have to be skillful to write very explicitly and coherently. By the same token, you have to be just as skillful as to write vaguely and non-committal. So, and that had political as well as personal implications. to just give you one small clue, yeah, the political is easy to understand. You would, you know, kick the can down the road, the proverbial can, and you make it the business of whoever comes after you to make a better deal. But in terms of personal histories, this explicit vagueness of composing documents, you could see in inheritance probates and the clerical skills to write as such, and people not knowing such nuances would certify those. And then future disputes would erupt in no time. And that had, in conjunction with the torpedoes of the Islamic laws of inheritance, that impacted the patterns of asset formation. So you don't have, if you're looking for discontinuity, it's not just the states. You can also see it in terms of the, private assets and so forth. And, inheritance is one historiographical parameter that you can gauge to analyze and to tell a much larger story. And here you go. I mean, you have this. So the short answer to the, again, a fascinating question, is that there was no central archives or even laws for it during the Qajar period, because the household, not only the household of the ministers were their office. When you look at the court, it was both the harem, the residence of the sovereign, as well as where some of the paperwork there was no phenomenological demarcations between where the Shah sleeps at night and where he keeps the, of course you have the exterior and the interior, but they were infused judicially, politically, and personally. By the beginning of the Pahlavi state that you have this very explicit demarcations of space in political institutions.
And two quick ones, please. The second question is, in the literature, we also find references to archives of embassies. Was that peculiar to the Amir Kabir period and then later on adopted by the Minister of Foreign Affairs?
The answer is yes.
Thank you.
I mean, a very qualified yes. Amir Kabir, let's not forget, he only had 2.5, maximum 3 years to initiate certain plans, which were quite remarkable. But it was from the time of Sepah Salar, who had witnessed, thanks to his appointments in Russia and in the Ottoman Empire, and his travels, that he could see the importance and the merits of keeping the records, as of course the volume of commercial and political transactions with these empires increased. But yes, I mean, the idea was from Amir Kabir, but it was interrupted. Then from the Sepah Salar on, it continued, then from there.
And briefly again, the final question is, in your opinion, did the situation in which the ministry was going home, not the minister to work concept, contribute to the cabinet sluggishness in presenting the documents required by the Majlis in the first term of the parliament?
Yes.
Okay, thank you for that. And last but not least, sorry, do you want to follow up?
Well, I mean, these are good questions.
Yeah, really, but you've got to be brief.
On this particular question, there is a place of a good book is empty.
Well, there is a call to arms.
I mean, this is amazing. Then you've got to go to muzakarat of the first majlis, which happily it's been published and been studied. Then you've got to go and see who's who and what kind of mandates they each have. So in fact, that aspect is extremely important. And I should also qualify what I said earlier on, the Pahlavi making a fresh start. Nothing is fresh start in that sense. Many of the prep work was done in precisely this question that under first majlis. And people, when you look at their CVs, the ones who were involved in the post 1925, what they were doing in 1910, this clearly comes into picture.
Ali, I have to say, it's your caliber and your esteem and recognition that has brought in such a distinguished audience to listen to you and also raise such extraordinarily interesting and important questions. And Professor Zarinbaf has written saying that it's time that we organize a workshop on Iranian archives. And for BIPS's benefit, I think there is a huge amount of interest in that going well beyond Britain and into the other corners of the world as well. Professor Purushariati has written thanking you for your exceptional presentation, and of course BIPS as well for being co-hosting, to whom I'm also grateful. Ali, you have been a star. And you have raised the spirits, as you said, in these rather depressing and testing times, to have you reflect on the past with such authority and also to be so generous in the way they responded to what were really quite important, challenging questions is absolutely remarkable. And it's mark of a good Anne Lambton lecturer that we and BIPS like to have. So cannot thank you on behalf of our 72 participants for having presented to us, for having agreed to come and speak to us and to write for us, and also to share your extraordinary depth of knowledge and expertise with us so generously and kindly. So I'm not on mute, so I can clap loudly and thank you warmly for your presentation. And can I thank our BIPS partners, as well as all the distinguished participants and colleagues who've taken time out of their busy schedules to be with us. Your presence is hugely appreciated. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much for hosting the event. I enjoyed it. And thank you everybody for fantastic questions.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.